I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the evolutionary advantages of friendliness. We'll spend this hour with anthropologist Brian Hare of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University, talking about new evidence that natural selection for hypersocial personalities might explain why Homo sapiens made it to modern times despite perilous population bottlenecks, while our stronger and possibly smarter Neanderthal cousins disappeared. Our conversation starts after a short break. Certainly not the slack-jawed brutes we once imagined them to be. Our prehistoric cousins were almost certainly stronger than we are, and they were smart. They had culture, the genetic capacity for speech, maybe even bigger brains than we had. So why did our kind, Homo sapiens, persist into the present day when Neanderthals ceased to exist as a distinct species some 40,000 years ago? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Think high school. Sure, the jocks and the valedictorians are automatically the superstars, but there's always that core of kids everybody likes, the friendly, outgoing ones who join a lot of different clubs, form study groups, and lend a helping hand to somebody in a jam. When the going gets tough, these kids continue to thrive in part because they're all in it together. Maybe the survival secret of our entire species was congeniality. Brian Hare is here to explain. He is professor in evolutionary anthropology and psychology and neuroscience and a core member of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University. His article, Survival of the Friendliest, written with Vanessa Woods, appears in the August issue of Scientific American. Brian, welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you so much, Chris.
So for a long time, we lay people at least assume that we are here and Neanderthals as a distinct species are gone because we must have been brighter than they were. What is some of the evidence that casts doubt on that?
Well, you know, it is true. Normally, when you ask people, why is it that humans are so different than other animals, we normally gravitate, as you said in your introduction, to our big brains and the fact we have language and we're doing what we're doing right now together and we have culture. But what we know based on the fossil record is that Neanderthals and as many as three to four other human species that were on this planet up to 50,000 years ago all had those same attributes. So if you want to actually describe what big brains and culture do for you, it's actually pretty well linked with extinction. And so it must be something else that allowed us to outsurvive the other big brain cultural humans and survive and thrive. And so that's sort of where we start the article that you're talking about. We've also written a book about it by the same title.
Oh, great. I will definitely look forward to picking that up because this kind of thing is fascinating to me. What kind of culture did Neanderthals have? And is there any way of knowing how it compared to early Homo sapiens culture?
Well, we know that Neanderthals who live mainly in Europe, but also were present in Asia as well, and potentially even in the Middle East, they had culture just like we do. They could build, there's evidence of technology and even different types of art. And they lived in groups like we do, and they were predators like we are. But one of the things that seems to be suggested by the fossil record that makes us different is the size of their groups. They tended to live in relatively small groups, and that limited how they could learn from each other. Also, it limited their, because they couldn't learn and innovate as quickly as we could, it limited their technology they had access to, which made them not as effective in terms of their ability to predate other species,
so,
to be predators.
Yeah, so one advantage that we have is that we don't have to learn everything ourselves in order to benefit from other people's innovations, right? We can share technologies and ideas with other groups. It sounds like maybe the Neanderthals did not do that.
So we are able to connect with others in a way that Neanderthals could not. And we think what evolved in our species that's really, really different is a new type of friendliness that allowed for a new type of cooperation. And the friendliness is the recognition that someone who's in a completely different group from us, somebody who's a total stranger we've never met before or don't know very well, is actually a member of our group, and that we care about them and can quickly learn to have concern for them the same way we do our own family members. And so we quickly can have very strong bonds with individuals we never met before or don't know. And we can learn from them, and we can work together and solve really serious problems together with those people. We don't think Neanderthals or other human species that evolved other than ourselves were able to do that. And if just like the internet revolutionized how we learn from each other, and so many people are connected, and we can go search for whatever we want now and find the answer to it, it's kind of the equivalent in the upper Paleolithic. It was a little bit more simple, but it would be kind of the same kind of revolution.
Okay, so the question now is, why are we friendlier than they were? And you say Homo sapiens experienced a phenomenon known as self-domestication. First of all, what is domestication exactly?
Well, domestication is a genetic change in a species that allows it to be friendly in a new way towards others. And typically, that changes how the organism develops. And when you change how an organism develops, there's byproducts, there are accidents that occur that also affect the body of an animal. So that's why you have all sorts of things like floppy ears and curly tails come along when you select an animal to be friendlier.
So, how did self-domestication change humans' bodies and brains over time?
Well, by looking at animals, and this has been one of the fun things, is that animals have actually helped us understand ourselves in really serious ways. So by looking at how animals are affected by domestication, and knowing that when you select an animal, even in experiments where you're controlling everything and you really understand what's going on, and you see that when you select for friendliness, there are these changes in the body that are pretty predictable. Well, then we can look at the fossil record in humans and say, well, gosh, if we compare ourselves to other humans, do we see any evidence for the kinds of changes we see in animal bodies? Because obviously we can't go talk to Neanderthal or find out, how friendly they are, et cetera. But we can look at the shapes of their bodies that are and see if they're consistent with what we see in other animals. And so we find evidence for that.
And it doesn't take very long at all. There was this famous experiment with foxes, right, that taught us a lot about this.
Yes. So when you select an animal to be friendly, within 10, 20 generations, you already see changes not only in their behavior towards others, but also in their body shape. So in the case of the foxes, their faces became shorter. They started to have more floppy ears and higher prevalence of curly tails. They also had a change in their body chemistry, and all of that is tied to how they developed. So it ended up to be a friendlier fox, you have to develop in a different way, and you change the hormones and the chemistry that allows for behavior to be more friendly. But those same hormones and chemistry shape cartilage and bone. And so then you get these changes both in how you behave or act towards others and what you look like.
Just to digress for a minute, there's a sidebar piece in Scientific American about how dogs were domesticated. We know that they like to please us and they're pretty good at reading our behaviors. Wolves, not so much. But the assumption that, like, we domesticated dogs by choosing the friendliest wolf pups, that turns out to not hold water.
It's a hard story to argue for. And the reason is because we now know when dogs evolved from wolves. And the process began before the first seed had ever been sowed in the ground. So it wasn't that a bunch of people with farms were like, hey, wouldn't it be great to turn some wolves into dogs and guard our flocks or guard our gardens or something? Wolves began evolving into dogs when everybody was still living as a forager, hunting and gathering, and actually directly competing for food against wolves. So the idea that, you're going to go get a bunch of wolf puppies and raise them and say, hey, let's leave them with our kids while we go hunt for food, they'll be great. That seems unlikely. So instead, what we think happened is that as humans started to live it more at a higher density, we did what we do well, and we still do it well today, is we create a lot of waste and all sorts of different kinds of waste that are very useful to other animals. And wolves in particular, we think, took advantage of the waste that we were creating. And those that were able to sneak in, not be aggressive, and were actually attracted to us, were at a major advantage. And so the selection for friendliness and attraction replacing what was fear is what jump-started dog domestication.
Okay, so a male wolf and a female wolf that were friendly enough, like not skittish enough to go to those garbage piles and look for food, they might have bred puppies that were even more like mom and dad.
That's right. That's the idea, is that two wolves or more that were able to sneak in at night and go get some garbage or go get whatever else was laying around would have a reliable source of food, because humans around 25,000 years ago became, which is about the time this process started, became super predators. And that's because of the use of projectile weapons. We all of a sudden had access to a weapon called the atlatl, a throwing spear. And shortly after that, there were other projectile weapons, including eventually the bow and arrow. And so we were incredibly successful as predators because of projectile weapons. And so instead of saying, hey, we're getting our clocks cleaned by these humans, they're really good at doing what they do, some wolves said, forget it, let's just scavenge. And boy, they made a good decision, because now there's over 100 million of them. And sadly, in most of the places where wolves have historically been, they're endangered.
So humans, on the other hand, they took in the friendlier wolves that were becoming dogs, and the mean wolves, or the wolves that humans feared, started to be hunted. Is that it?
I don't know if they were hunted, but they certainly would not have been tolerated the same way that dogs or proto-dogs that began evolving, which, of course, as they were selecting themselves to be friendlier and friendlier towards humans, would start to look different, because we know that friendliness has a predictable change on the body and appearance. People would have been tolerant to, oh, those are just the wolves that always scavenge, who cares? And there are these other wolves that are still trying to compete with us for food. And yeah, I think people would be humans would have been more likely to be annoyed by that.
So there are naturally occurring wolves and dogs on a number of different continents. Did the process probably happen precisely the same way in many different places?
Well, that's an unresolved question. There's a lot of debate about that. Geneticists and archaeologists have worked really hard trying to figure out where dogs may have first evolved, whether it happened once, did it happen with a special population of wolves? And I think we're going to learn more. There's been so much back and forth about that I think the best thing to say right now is we're going to get better resolution, because there is now the capability of looking at ancient DNA. This is extracting DNA from long ago dead individuals, and finding out how they compare to modern dogs and modern wolves. And so I think we're going to get some surprising answers. But there's been debate about did it happen multiple places or not.
How is that ancient DNA extracted? Are there bones that are buried in such a way that marrow remains or something remains that provides a useful sample?
Yeah, so it's an incredibly technical process, and only certain bones actually have material that can be sampled. If you're lucky enough to find one and be able to harvest and be able to get DNA that's sampleable, I mean, it has absolutely the most valuable information. Really, it's like time travel.
My guest is Brian Hare. He's professor in evolutionary anthropology and psychology and neuroscience, and a core member of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University. His book is called Survival of the Friendliness. There's also an article by the same title in Scientific American this August. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. enjoyed. My guest this hour is Brian Hare, who is professor in evolutionary anthropology and psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. His book, written with Vanessa Woods, is called Survival of the Friendliest: Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. First on the line, we have Sam calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Sam.
Hey, got a question for Brian, but before that, just want to say absolutely loving this conversation. It's very interesting.
Oh, great.
So my question is, so I have a husky that looks like almost like a wolf, and he exhibits some of the same things that you are talking about, curls up his tail when he's lovey-dovey, flops his ears down, otherwise he has very pointy ears. So just absolutely, when I was listening to that, I said, that's my dog. Now, I've accepted a wolf into my home, which is my husky. But if I see a wolf or some other dog, like a coyote, not a dog, but of the family, then I don't like that. So why are we as humans having this discrimination against some dog species and some not?
Thanks for calling.
Sam, what a cool question. And it's something actually we think a lot about. I don't know that I even know the answer to why it is that some dogs are treated like kings and others are not. I mean, there's traditions in the United States South. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I used to go hunting and as a kid, and the hunting dogs were treated really differently than pet dogs. Cross-culturally, some dogs are treated really well. Like in Australia, people love their pet dogs, but they don't like dingoes, even though dingoes are domesticated, wild roaming dogs. So it's a great question to point out this paradox.
You note that as we domesticated, Homo sapien males produced less testosterone on average. Did men's bodies change more than women's as a result of our domestication?
Well, I wish we knew the answer to that question. It's a great question. So we examined fossil humans trying to look for evidence of friendliness, and we found that we have friendlier faces. So that's sort of what you're referring to, is that we have shorter faces, we have narrower faces, and our other human species had huge brow ridges, sort of this vault above your eyes. It was like an overhanging cliff on most other species, but ours disappear. And those are all signs of hormonal changes that are consistent with what we see in other animals as they get selected to be friendly. And so your question about male versus female is a good one. We don't know, because the fossil record we have isn't big enough. We have dozens of individuals. We don't have hundreds, and we'd need many more to be able to understand the relative effect on sex. But I will say, maybe we're going to talk about bonobos later, and I have more to say about that.
Well, let's talk about bonobos versus chimps. Chimps are known to be pretty belligerent, or they can be, and bonobos are friendlier and kind of female dominated. So how does all that play into what we're talking about?
Well, first of all, for your listeners, you are very lucky that in North Texas, the Fort Worth Zoo has one of the country's only collections of bonobos. Huh. So you, unlike most people, could go see them, what we're going to talk about next. I would have to drive 8 hours to go see the closest bonobo in Ohio from North Carolina. So go see them. They're awesome. But bonobos are one of our two closest living relatives. We're really lucky. We have two cousins in the primate world. It's like having a first cousin who's a girl and a boy. They're equally closely related, but they're different from each other. That's how bonobos and chimps are to us. We know much. All of us are more familiar with chimpanzees. They do have horrific potential for violence. While they can be wonderful and they're as warm and social and can be kind like humans, they also have a darker side. And comparisons have shown that chimpanzees have homicide rates that are equal to the rates in some human cultures. So chimpicide is a real thing. Bonobos do not have any of that. No bonobo has ever been observed to kill another bonobo. And as you referred to, it has something to do with the relationship between males and females. And what's been seen in bonobos is that, unlike chimpanzees, where a male chimpanzee will use power to dominate and take power away from everyone. In bonobos, when there's competition and if there's any fighting, the fighting is all about making sure that no one bonobo takes over the group. And so females will work together to prevent any male from trying to take over the group. And that has created a very strong selection pressure for male bonobos to be friendly.
So how does that translate to intergroup behavior? Is one little tribe of bonobos more welcoming to another one it's introduced to than one little tribe of chimps?
So chimpanzees will, guard the border to their territory. They'll go together in groups of as many as 40 individuals, and they will go around their border. And if they find a neighbor that's by themselves or in a smaller group, they'll attack, and they may even kill them. And there's very nice work, hard fought for data from East Africa and West Africa showing that chimpanzees will slowly eliminate the rival neighbors and take their territory from them. And they do it through grisly murders and all sorts of stuff that is, you know, of nightmares. Bonobos, when they meet strangers, and this is my own work, we've been able to show that they actually are attracted to strangers and have very friendly relationships with them. They actually enjoy meeting new bonobos that they haven't known before, and they share food with them, and they'll travel together and have very friendly relationships. And mostly it's because the females just absolutely do not tolerate male aggression in the way that it occurs in chimpanzees.
How would we humans have selected for friendliness without necessarily intending to do so? Was it as simple as early humans being more attracted to partners with good personalities?
So I think bonobos provide a nice example there, where female bonobos were able to prevent male aggression and basically by choosing males who were friendlier and preferring to mate and have offspring with friendlier males, male bonobos actually, and you asked me earlier about differences between males and females, they actually have changed in terms of their hormonal profile and their behavior in dramatic ways from chimpanzees. One of the things that always surprises people is that because bonobo males are sort of a little bit more slender and less muscular and friendly and aren't aggressive the way that chimpanzee males are, people are surprised when I tell them that actually the most successful bonobo male at having offspring is far more successful than the most despotic alpha male chimpanzee. So all that aggression doesn't pay off in terms of offspring. Actually, friendliness wins. So I think the story in humans is very similar, where being friendly paid off in terms of your success at having offspring.
So this change, this set of changes in humans all started happening about 80,000 years ago. What else was happening at that time that might explain the ways we started to change?
Well, the thinking is that over the last 100,000 years, humans were pulsing out of Africa. We start moving into the rest of the world. And we started living in certain places just before all those pulses started to occur. We started to live at higher densities. And when you were living at higher densities, we were forced into contact in a way that we weren't before. And unlike other human species, we found a way to be friendly to one another because we were attracted to people who were strangers, as long as they had a group identity, as long as they had some signal or marker that they were like us, we could become fast friends with them and we weren't threatened by them. So unlike chimpanzees and bonobos, who are only recognize others based on whether they're familiar or not, we can recognize others based on whether they're unfamiliar or familiar. But we also have this new thing where we can see, oh, they have a marker of my group. So even though I've never seen that person before, I can quickly be friends. If you root for my sports team, you know, if I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan, I bet I can have a bunch of friends in Dallas really quick.
Okay, so we can have multiple group identities. We might have grown up together, or we might see somebody, wearing the jersey that we like, or say, oh, she's a mom too, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And it's even more dramatic than that. What I'm suggesting is that just like chimpanzees and bonobos do not have group identity. They just recognize each individual as familiar or unfamiliar. There's nothing that you know, this group is the group of red bonobos, and those are the blue bonobos, and red bonobos are this way. They don't recognize anything like that at all. They just know, oh, I know that guy, I don't know that guy. And Neanderthals, we think we're the same. And really, it's humans that evolved this new type of social category and recognized group identity for the first time, and it was revolutionary.
So over time, we had less testosterone and more serotonin. What did the serotonin do for us?
Well, when you have increases in serotonin, it really reduces your aggressive impulses potentially, and that we see that in a lot of different animals, including those foxes we were talking about earlier. One of the first things that happens when you select animals for friendliness, including the foxes, is you have a major increase in brain serotonin levels. The foxes have 5 times the level of serotonin in their brains that foxes, the comparison group that was not selected for friendliness, has. So we think that something similar happened in humans, and that allowed us to, instead of sort of impulsively be aggressive, to take a moment, be a little bit more inhibited, and think about, hey, wait a second, I could really benefit from a relationship.
You mentioned those brow ridges that we lost as we split from Neanderthals. How are Homo sapien heads otherwise different from Neanderthal heads?
Well, this is funny because I can give you a really nice compliment, and a really esoteric but nice compliment you can give someone, which is if you say, "Boy, you have a beautifully globular head." That's a wonderful thing to say to a human being because it is the defining trait of our species from other humans, other species of humans that are now extinct. We have a very spherical shaped head, which is called globularity. And Neanderthals had a more football-shaped head, and Homo erectus had their own, that's another species of human, had their own funny-shaped head, but we have a spherical shape, and we think this globular shape is due to an increase in serotonin. In fact, it's evidence of that increase in serotonin, because we know in other animals that when you manipulate levels of serotonin when they're developing early in fetal development, that you end up with more globular-shaped skulls. So our round heads are evidence of our friendliness, just like our faces are.
Okay, so I'm looking at a picture of this on my iPad right now, and it looks like our globular heads contained smaller brains. So as our skulls got smaller because of the serotonin and other things, did we trade away some intellectual capacity that our Neanderthal cousins might have had?
Well, this is one of the fun shockers, is that when you domesticate an animal, you have a reduction in their brain size as much as 20%. And for instance, dogs and wolves that would be the same size, your dog is going to have a smaller brain. The same is actually seen when you compare male bonobos to chimpanzee males. Male chimpanzees' brains are about 20% larger than a similarly sized bonobo male. And when you look at humans and you compare us to Neanderthals, there's some evidence, particularly late in the last 20,000 years, that our brains have been shrinking, that we have smaller brains as we have become friendlier. In terms of intelligence, we have a different kind of intelligence. We can rely on each other. And so, in fact, we're actually much smarter. It's just as individuals, each individual might not be.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phone now. We have Ariel calling us from Arlington, Texas. Hi, Ariel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question is how you think, in a professional sense, through your research, when you see diversity in our international community. During the interview with John Stewart, he says that diversity is a very unnatural concept for humans. And do you think the fact that we've become more diverse, or the fact that we kind of try to keep isolating ourselves, is that a sense of progressive movement, or is it the fact that when we try to step back and isolate and put up more walls or break up our countries, is that a sign going backwards?
Thanks for calling.
Oh, what a great timely question, because in our book and in the article, you know, we've been talking about evidence for friendliness and how our species had an advantage because we became friendlier. But we think the same psychology that allowed for friendliness has the ability to turn off. And that when we, because we love our groups more, when we had group identity, as group identity evolved and it allowed us to love those that we didn't know or weren't related to more than we see in other human extinct species, it also set up the possibility that we feel threatened when those, when that larger group has problems. And so we think the psychology that allows us to care and love for non-family members, it can turn off. And when it turns off, our empathy and compassion becomes more like a focused spotlight on our own group. And we can exclude other groups and other identities that threaten our own in a way that probably didn't exist in other species as well. So basically the friendliness then came with it the cost of the need or motivation to defend those we love, and it allows us for, it sets up the potential for us to be incredibly cruel.
Is there an evolutionary advantage to our bodies being a little less muscular? Like, we don't have such a great need for calories as our Neanderthal cousins might have had?
Yes, there has been an argument that Neanderthals so humans actually use a ton of calories relative to other primates. My close colleague has argued that humans are sort of the SUV of the primate world. But Neanderthals may have been even more so, because as you say, they had far more muscle mass and they may have been less energy efficient. I think the main constraint for them, though, is that there's no evidence they had projectile weapons like we did or the group size. And so I think they were at a major disadvantage for innovating and for cooperating in large groups. And so they were much more vulnerable to wide sweeping changes in environmental or climate, et cetera.
Brian Hare is my guest. He's professor in evolutionary anthropology and psychology and neuroscience and a core member of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University. His book is called Survival of the Friendliness. There's also an article by the same title in Scientific American this August. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Brian Hare, who is professor in evolutionary anthropology and psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. His book, written with Vanessa Woods, is called Survival of the Friendliest: Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. Brian, what accounts for all the modern humans, I guess mostly modern humans of European descent, who have some Neanderthal genes? Were the earliest hybrids likely the product of like sexual assault, like Neanderthal on Homo sapien, or might there have been some friendly Neanderthals who were like welcome among the Homo sapiens?
Well, that is the topic of great interest in the scientific community. I think the main work that will reveal answers to that is going to be looking at ancient DNA, and I don't do that type of research. And I know that there are very healthy debates, let's say, about whether our relationship with Neanderthals was amorous only, or was it that and friendly, or was it that really there was intergroup conflict and a lot of the exchange of genetic material happened through coercion. And so I don't know more than that yet. I think we're going to have to keep working.
So we modern humans still find lots of reasons to fight one another. Can you talk about the blessing and the curse of all the oxytocin we produce?
Yeah, so I oxytocin is a chemical in our bodies and our brains, and it's gotten it's had a lot of good PR. It's often called the hug hormone, but I prefer to call it the mama bear hormone. Mm. And I like to call it the mama bear hormone, because when you see a bear or any other mother interacting with its offspring, oh, there's nothing more beautiful, loving, and nurturing. But everybody knows that that is the most dangerous time to go near a bear or any other mother, is if you're going to interfere with her offspring. You better be ready, because you're going to probably receive some pretty serious aggression, because if her offspring are threatened, She's going to defend them. And that is oxytocin at work. The same hormone that causes the bonding and nurturing behavior also causes the aggression under threat. And we think that that system has been really amped up in our own species in the same regard, but when it comes to our group identity, when we identify those like us as our family, we're nurturing and loving and the most caring and kind, friendly species. But if we feel our group is threatened, it shuts down the parts of our mind that allow us to show compassion and be empathy, and we can exclude others that might not have that same identity morally and treat them with cruelty.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Swaroop on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Swaroop.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, Professor Hare, for such a fascinating conversation. My question is, there is a popular notion that is still quite prevalent that says that people usually use friendliness or congeniality as a compensation mechanism for what they may lack in talent or hard work to get the same, gain the same sense of significance or influence. Is there any truth to this notion?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I'm defining friendliness from a biological perspective, it doesn't have to be selfless, what I'm describing. When you're being friendly and it's paying off in terms of you're better able to have offspring and you're a better cooperator, that's fine that it has a selfish outcome in terms of when we're talking about biology and how things evolve. Friendliness really, the title of the book is Survival of the Friendliest, because we're really trying to head on deal with everybody's misunderstanding about the phrase survival of the fittest, because normally people think fit means you're bigger, stronger, and meaner, and that's how you get ahead in life, and that there must be evidence for this in biology. And nothing could be further from the truth. The most effective and successful strategy we see over and over in life is friendliness. Friendliness wins, and it wins big. And it's because it allows for new forms of cooperation. And it seems our species is built for friendliness too.
It seems pretty obvious that, like, looking out for others like us is a good collective survival strategy. Why haven't all creatures evolved something like this? Or why haven't most creatures evolved something like this? Why are there only some social animals who would, put themselves at risk for another?
Well, it really, there's a cost-benefit ratio. And sometimes the cost-benefit ratio works to defeat friendliness. So take chimpanzees. They're a very successful species. The reason that they don't have bonobo-like friendliness is because the food they have available prevents females from spending time together and becoming friends. They're rivals. They have to fight each other for the food because it's distributed so thinly. So then when there's a lot of food and they get together and the males are being brutish and beating them up, they don't defend each other. They let the female they normally compete against get beaten up. And so the cost of friendliness is too high in chimpanzee land. In bonobo land, the way that food is distributed, it's very easy for females to form friendships, and they don't put up with male aggression as a result, because they're fast friends.
So a lot of religions have, like, turn the other cheek, do unto others as you'd have others do unto you, and those kinds of things where we are reminded to look out for other people. Do you think that as, cultures sort of took these things on and made them prescriptions for people, they actually resulted from a sense that we already had, that, like, our bodies and brains already wired us to be this way, and then we just sort of wrote it down?
Absolutely. I don't think there's chance that, do unto others is there's some version of the golden rule in every successful religion. I don't think that's chance. I think that's because it's an expression of our human nature that then is expressed through culture. And when you see something so universally expressed, that there's probably more to it. So and I do think that I think science has a little bit more to add to that, which is it's not just do unto others as you wish they would do unto you. It is, we desperately, if we would like to expand our circle of concern and be more successful and have a friendlier future, even still, I think there's a new rule that we can learn from what we've seen biologically, which is we all need to form friends with those who are not in groups that we see as like our own. That would do a ton to promise a more friendly future.
What's the best way to do that? I mean, not everybody can move into a densely populated city, and it doesn't seem that watching TV helps us very much to relate to different kinds of people. It tends to divide us more.
Well, it can. There is some evidence, actually, that as TV has used more diverse types of actors and representations, that people have become more tolerant. It definitely can. But the best, obviously, is to form friends. And of course, in this time where we're all socially distanced, that can be difficult. But that is, any way we can find to be fast friends, whether it's through sports or through school or through clubs, any kind of interaction where you can form friends with those that are not like you, you are helping society in a big way.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Nathaniel is calling from Dallas. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Very well, thanks.
All right, so my question is more to do with the short term in someone's lifespan or maybe in one generation past the first person. You're talking about serotonin and testosterone in males heavily affecting the way they behave as far as friendliness and working together with others. My question is how a child or young adult is treated as they grow up can affect how their body forms and their behaviors form as they grow up. Example, a father putting their son in hockey or football when they're very young, acting very aggressive, also encouraging teamwork, but encouraging that more testosterone-like behavior versus someone who puts their kids through chess club as a very demure parenting style like my parents, where does that have any effect on how that their brain develops and how their body looks as they get older?
Thanks for calling.
And how that translates from generation to generation, but really just short-term curiosity for my part.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, to really answer your very good question, we'd need a twin study. Mm. And so when you're comparing different families, it doesn't really work because there can be personality differences. There can be differences between different motivation and interest, and also just even athletic ability that would lead someone to be more interested in chess and somebody more interested in football. So we'd have to do some kind of twin study to get at your question, but it's a good one.
So I think women the world over are still, feeling as if we're kind of shaking off the chains of patriarchy. Do we have the capacity as humans to be ultimately bonobo-like, or are we always at risk of, turning back into chimps in terms of our collective behavior and the sort of balance of power?
Yeah, I'm sure all of us feel stressed right now about how we're all, how we could do better getting along. And so I think the message here is that we are built for friendliness. Our species really has survived and thrived because we found a new way to be friendly. And the challenge for us, if we want to continue to survive and thrive, is can we get beyond this really amazing ability we have to recognize group identities and to embrace larger group identities become friends with those from other groups, because we know that when we do that, that reduces not only the threat we might feel towards our own identity by members of another group that might be doing things to make us feel threatened. If we have a friend from that other group, it tends to reduce our feelings of threat. It also makes it less likely that we would see that other group as not deserving of moral concern and vice versa. These cross-group friendships really hold a lot of promise for helping us, continue to increase our friendliness. Now, you asked me specifically about women versus men. It is absolutely the case that bonobos prevent the worst forms of aggression towards women as well. No bonobos coerce females or do anything. In fact, the last thing you do as a bonobo is hurt your mother, whereas that's actually the first thing you do when you become a teenage male chimpanzee is you start to attack your mom as a safe way to practice your dominance that you're going to use on other group members.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it is absolutely the case that bonobos are a wonderful example of females forming coalitions to prevent male aggression. But I think there's a larger point because, you know, men and women have group identity. And so it's actually a larger problem than just the male-female dichotomy that we struggle with as well. It's also the fact that all humans respond to group identity. And the question is, how do we have enlarge our circle of concern?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have an email here from Kathleen who wants to know, based on what you're saying about the behavioral differences between chimps and bonobos, why so many observational primate studies have focused on chimps and not bonobos?
What a great question. Oh, I love that. I love that email. I've wondered that myself, because I think some of the greatest secrets for a friendlier future are hidden in trying to understand the psychology of bonobos. So again, if you're in North Texas and you can get to the Fort Worth Zoo, how lucky are you that you can go visit our close relative that has this much friendlier way? They have brains a third the size of ours, but they can do something we can't, which is no bonobo wakes up in the morning and ever has to worry that another bonobo will murder them or harm them or threaten their lives. Wow.
If you had to predict the future of human evolution, how do you imagine we might be physically and emotionally and mentally different 1,000 generations from now?
Well, a lot of people, when I talk about human self-domestication, they arrive to the conclusion, oh, we should breed people to be friendlier. We should select people to be friendlier. You just said that they selected the foxes and the bonobo females selected males to be friendlier. Why not humans? Well, first of all, it would end up all roads lead to a morally repugnant place where mm-hmm. we're talking about eugenics, where institutional control of who's reproducing and who's not. So not only is that morally repugnant, but it just wouldn't work. It ends up that the genes that control human behavior are buffered against tremendous amounts of evolution or rapid evolution. And that's because there's thousands of genes in our genome that are implicated in behavior. So it's very difficult. And we don't even know what the genes are. And then the last thing is, when they selected the foxes in that experiment, less than 1% of the foxes, they would take the friendliest foxes and breed them together, but only 1% were selected for that breeding. To do that with humans would be impossible. There's 7 billion of us.
Brian Hare is professor in evolutionary anthropology at Duke. His new book, written with Vanessa Woods, is Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. Brian, thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was great fun.
You can listen anytime on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.